everyone. I'm Gary Nolan. I'd like to welcome you to our program today. This will be a continuation of our series, Conversations with Remarkable Minds. Normally we have one person on. Today we have two. First up, we'll be speaking with Professor Simon Johnson on the national debt and deficit conundrum and why it matters to us and why the upcoming debates that we're going to see and the positions they're taking, from my perspective, will do little to change the actual outcome on the ground for at least 240 million Americans. Professor Simon Johnson is the Ronald Kurtz Professor of Entrepreneurship at MIT Sloan School of Management, where he specializes in financial and economic crisis. He is the member of the Congressional Budget Office's panel of economic advisors and the FDIC's Systemic Resolution Advisory Committee and the president of the Association for Comparative Economic Studies. And from 2007 to 2008, he served as the chief economist for the International Monetary Fund and the director of its research department, where he focused on formulating innovative responses to the global financial crisis. So he will be first up. Then in the second part of our program, we'll be speaking with Professor Richard Davidson. Professor Davidson is the William James and Villis Research Professor of Psychology and Psychiatry in the Investigative Health Minds Center at the University of Wisconsin. He's regarded by many as a leading pioneer in the new discipline of brain research known as affective neuroscience. He's the recipient of many awards for his research into brain imaging and analysis, including the National Institute of Mental Health Research Scientist Award and Distinguished Investigator Award from the National Alliance of Research into Schizophrenia Affective Disorders. We're going to talk with him about, can we remake our minds? Can we create a different mindset than what we've lived with up to this point? That would be changing the way the reductionistic linear field of psychiatry and psychology has thought about our brains, that the brain is immutable, it's not changeable, only our thoughts are changeable. Well, not according to Professor Davidson. So we're going to look at the state-of-the-art of neuroscientific advances in the understanding of the emotional life of the brain, how we think, feel, and love, and how contemplative practice can change the brain from negative emotions. That should be very interesting. But first, let's introduce our guest, Professor Simon Johnson. Nice to have you with us today, sir.
Thanks for having me.
We all are aware of the crisis that we're faced today. It's just not all of us understand it as you might, and therefore have the insights that you can impart to us. Many political analysts and commentators now believe that the debate on the national debt and deficits will be the single most important issue during the forthcoming presidential election. The debates across the aisle are furious regarding to what degree we should be implementing austerity measures and cutbacks in social services to Americans, including Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. However, it seems quite clear that Americans do not understand clearly what the national debt actually is and why it makes up 80% of the gross domestic product and now stands at close to $16 trillion and growing. So first, would you give us a version, like a classroom on the air, of what the national debt actually is and several of the main factors or forces that are driving it upwards?
Sure, I'd be happy to do that, Gary. The national debt is money that the government has borrowed, the federal government in this instance. It's borrowed for investment purposes in some cases. It's also borrowed more recently because since 2000 we had a big tax cut, two foreign wars, expansion of Medicare to cover prescription medicines, and then, of course, the enormous financial crisis, which by itself is the second largest shock to our public finances since World War II. You put all these things together, and we've had a sharp increase in government borrowing to buffer our way through these difficulties. And the amount of debt right now, the debt held by the public is about $10.8 trillion. That's about 73% of our gross domestic product. That's a high level of debt. It's not yet a dangerous level, but it's rising, and we need to take measures that will bring that debt under control. Don't have to reduce it to zero. There's absolutely no need to do that in the modern economy, but you have to prevent it from expanding without limit. And that's what the discussion is about, or should be about. What are the responsible ways to bring the debt under control? We don't need precipitate austerity, which is what the Europeans are doing. We don't need to slash programs indiscriminately. We don't need massive immediate tax hikes on people, but we need a change in policies and a better way of approaching our public finances over the next two decades.
Thank you. I appreciate that answer. Let's go through this then step by step. Briefly summarize how the debate between fiscal responsibility versus incurring debt as means for domestic growth have been with us since the founding of the Republic, and then briefly share how each of the two political parties perceive debt and deficits, perhaps ideologically, as a threat to restoring economic growth, so we have a better sense of where we're at.
Well, the interesting thing about the American fiscal tradition is that for a long time, politicians were very careful. Now, there were some problems at the beginning of the Republic. The War of Independence was not well managed from a public finance point of view, and the Continental Army was not well supplied as a result. And there was a fiscal disaster in the War of 1812, but that proved a salutary lesson. And for about 170 years subsequent to that, politicians across the political spectrum were really quite careful and did not engage in profligate spending or out-of-control deficits. Most of the debt that was issued was during periods of national emergency, the Civil War. The North issued quite a bit of debt. World War I and World War II was the biggest issue of debt on record. So public finances were roughly in balance in good years. In difficult times, debt would increase, but then that debt would be brought down subsequent to the crisis over a period of decades. What really changed in the modern era is that the right of the American political spectrum started to care much less about balancing the budget and much more about cutting taxes. This first came to the forefront under Ronald Reagan. Although Reagan first cut taxes and raised taxes, other politicians, such as Newt Gingrich, took up the idea that taxes should only ever be cut, and this became something has become something of a mantra on the right of the political spectrum, and was represented most vividly and, I'm afraid, ultimately most damagingly by the Bush-era tax cuts, which we really couldn't afford, and which put the debt on a much higher trajectory. And that's where we are today. Today, the two parties obviously have their different preferences with regard to what you should do if you could expand. Democrats will prefer spending, by and large. The Republicans would prefer cutting taxes. But the unfortunate fact of the matter is we have a lot of debt. The debt is rising. The financial crisis was an awful shock to revenue, mostly the loss of revenue that did the damage. And we need to bring the budget under control. Neither side, unfortunately, is yet willing to level with you and to explain that we need to strengthen revenue. We need to go back to the kind of revenue base we had in the 1990s, which is not so long ago, but it seems quite hard to reach given the modern political impasse.
We're assuming that we really only have two responsible ideas here, one that is the official left and the official right. But when I look at it, I see that we're leaving out of the equation those individuals who no longer subscribe to an official or corporate mindset of how we should approach the problems, the more independent and progressive minds who see a completely different dynamic involved. Would you explore this, that if in times like today, it really is, it's an illusion that we have two completely diametrically opposite powers at work here, because when I look at the Democrats coming in and hailing a more progressive and more compassionate way of doing business and how we're going to balance our budget, and then I see all the people who are put into positions of power who are actually going to be directing that and implementing it, Larry Summers and Timothy Geithner, and these are people who I do not consider either progressive or representing the Franklin Roosevelt more idealistic liberal Democrat position. I see them as more of a corporate Democrat position. Your thoughts on this, please.
Well, I think corporate Democrat may be a good title, a good name for them. Actually, Gary, you might want to patent that. Certainly, it's true that within there's a range of Democrats elected to national office. Within what we see right now in Washington, those who hold power in the administration are disproportionately corporate Democrats, as you describe them. There are more progressive Democrats in Congress, some of whom I think are very, very sensible on these issues. And the right, the political spectrum, and that's where the corporate Democrats have been pooled, is all about tax cuts. And I'm afraid that is going to be a big part of what the Obama administration presents to you for the November election. I think a much more sensible approach, I regard it as a moderate approach, we can also call it a progressive approach, that's fine with me too, is look at what the government actually does. Look at what the federal government does. 20% of federal government spending is on Social Security. 15% is on Medicare. Another 10% or more is on Medicaid and other programs, many of which are used extensively by the middle class. Look at these programs. Decide whether you think they make sense. Average Social Security pension is only $13,000 a year. You're not going to get rich on that. It's a basic safety net. It is there in case you outlive your assets and outlive your family's ability to support you. Medicare is the only way you're going to have decent health care services for people in their 70s, 80s, and 90s. There was no viable private health care insurance for elderly Americans before Medicare was invented, and there will be none if you scrap Medicare. These are what's regarded as uninsurable risks by the private market. So either society's involved in helping people when they get older and can't afford decent access to health care, or the people are going to be on their own. And you can have very poor elderly people with no access to decent health care. Those are the choices you make. We need to have that discussion. We need to focus on sensible role of government. And then we figure out how to pay for it. And in our book, we lay out a menu of choices. We make a recommendation off the menu, but you can pick another combination if you want. The point is, have that discussion in the open, responsibly. Don't just go around saying, oh, yes, let's have another tax cut. Great. You can win some votes with that, sure, short term, but that is a path to fiscal disaster.
Thank you for that insight. I appreciate it. I'd like to expand that notion a bit, because that's where I spend a lot of time, looking at how we get sick and what can we do to prevent that. And almost nowhere in the current health care model or in Obama's health care plan, when I read all of it, page per page, every word, did I see any blueprint for preventing disease, and especially the disease in the age 45 and older, which we now have 90 million. When you have 90 million people and you have no preventative health program, to the contrary, the vast majority of items you see offered to us, promoted to us, from fast foods and the beverages and the, 64-liter colas that a teenager is supposed to drink now, the supersized meals, are going to contribute to disease. Okay, as you mentioned, rightly so. So we end up getting sick. Someone has to pay for it. And we see what happens when people do not have insurance, and or there's no reasonable insurance except for private insurance or government-mandated insurance, which is just giving the private industry that capacity to make sure that we have to invest in them, then bring it back. No one's talking. There's no open debate about how do we prevent disease to help lower these costs. Or if a person is sick, why does it cost $1,200 to spend a night in a New York City hospital? True story. We actually did this, wrote an article on it. No medical care, no drugs, no food, just a bed. A normal, everyday bed in a hospital costs more than if you spent that same night, because we called in the Waldorf Astoria, in one of its nicest suites. And that's just for the bed. And then you start seeing why we have so much problems with medical bills. Now, my further extension on that, since Medicare and Medicaid now account for 3/5 that you just mentioned, combined to the federal budget, and will increase as more boomers enter retirement, which is every 7 seconds, we're really looking at huge national crisis ahead. I support a single-payer health care plan for all. For the financial reviews, I've seen comparing a single-payer system with what we have now, when it is combined with ousting big pharma and private insurance lobbying interests, for example, opening up to generic inexpensive drugs and better regulating and reforming how drug makers manage to extend patent life in order to keep the drug and device cost upwards of 1,500% more than manufacturing costs. The evidence seems clear to me that we would be saving tens, if not hundreds of billions annually on the single-payer system and also be providing better health services. In short, do you recommend health care reform, preserving Medicare and Medicaid, and also reducing debt costs?
Yes, absolutely. We want to preserve Medicare, Medicaid, and reduce, contain, limit health care costs. And I think the logic of a single-payer system, if run properly and carefully, there are better and worse ways to run them. But a single-payer system is actually absolutely where we're going to end up. I don't think we'll get there for some decades. There is obviously such a high degree of polarization around healthcare. You've seen that with the Affordable Care Act under President Obama. And we're talking about some of the most powerful corporate lobbies in American history. I don't think they're going to go quietly into the night. Nevertheless, if you don't control healthcare costs, they will eat the rest of the economy, and this will be increasingly a challenge and a problem to the rest of the private sector. And I talk to private sector CEOs and CFOs quite a lot, and one of the topics that I bring up with them and insist on covering is healthcare costs 20 or 30 years from now. Companies are going to be increasingly burdened by the way we run our system at the moment. Moving to a responsible single-payer version, some version of a single-payer system, is our best hope for controlling healthcare costs. Moving away from fee-for-service, moving towards more effective preventative healthcare of the kind you mentioned. This is a sensible prescription from a fiscal point of view, as well as from a physical health point of view.
This may seem a little abstract to our discussion, but I'm merely curious on it. What has been the consequences of the legacy Nixon left when the dollar was taken off the gold standard?
Well, that's an interesting question. Certainly, the gold standard at one point was an anchor for the politicians, and it constrained what they thought they could get away with because they were afraid that the U.S. would lose gold and that the international system would press them to reverse their policies. Since we went off gold in 1971, but actually before that, the sense of responsibility had begun to drift away, and it created what you might call a permissive intellectual and policy environment. But I would emphasize that that environment did not go bad from a fiscal sustainability point of view until the tax cut philosophy really came to the forefront and became paramount. It's the obsession, unhealthy obsession with tax cuts above all, and with shrinking government irrespective of what government does or what government wants, what people want from government. That combination turns out to be quite toxic and has really undermined the tradition of fiscal responsibility that, when you go back and look at the historical record, you realize that was a big part of how this country became prosperous and how it became influential in the world.
I'm going to ask you a philosophical question that is based upon pure pragmatism. When we hear one side say, cut the taxes and let the wealthy accumulate more money and it will trickle down, and then I ask them, how does that work? Give us examples of how having people pay no taxes, or corporations like General Electric, which made $5.1 billion last year and paid no taxes, and now just announced that they're closing down one of their largest factories in Michigan and that makes x-rays and sending it off to Beijing with $2 billion and training 95 engineers who will be running that. And show me how exactly that works with a lot of examples. On the other end, I hear many on the Democratic side saying the government must create these jobs, and that's how we're going to jumpstart the economy. And then I ask them, all right, let's be specific. There are more than 122 foundations in the Washington area that do nothing but specialize in looking at how government spends money. And when I looked at these reports, I see in the Department of Defense that there are at least 16 major agencies that have no accountability on where they spend their money. And multiple times I have seen where the government, when asked to do something, frequently does it at excessive cost and not at high quality. And as sometimes there's 10 separate independent companies doing the same identical work that one alone should do instead of all the rest. But once you're in that whole circle, it becomes self-feeding. And so I say we should be responsible for having a government that actually serves our needs in an efficient and purposeful manner, or simply allow it to become bloated and bureaucratic and indifferent. So when you say one should we should put our interest here to create jobs, and then I say, but where are the actual jobs created, and what do those jobs do? And wouldn't it make sense to put jobs where we actually have other jobs come from those jobs, like a small business person in a town? And why aren't we doing anything in that direction instead of bloated bureaucracies that more often than not on audit and careful inspection didn't live up to their promise, or give them money and save the taxes to the rich and nothing trickles down? And I'm very concerned that we're not looking carefully enough, with enough detail and dispassionately, to see the consequences of those two primary places. Could you address this both historically and today?
Well, historically, obviously, the U.S. has been a private sector-driven economy, and lots of good jobs were provided by the private sector after World War II. That's the basis of the growth of the American middle class. Federal government employment has never been that large in this country, and it's actually shrunk as a percent of the workforce, as a percent of the population in recent decades. I think you raised the right question, Gary, which is what's the best way to generate good jobs going forward? And, of course, you're right that trickle-down in the sense of cut taxes for rich people has not had a good track record. This has been done, of course. This was the idea behind the Bush tax cuts in 2001, 2002. And that decade, even before the crisis, the decade of the 2000s was very disappointing, both in terms of overall growth and the quality of jobs. At the same time, and the kind of jobs you get for people with middle-level education, middle skills, those jobs have been going away. At the same time, having the government create jobs directly does not seem like a good idea, particularly in this economy. I think we need to have a much broader-based development. And the vision of government we have in our book is not a expansive, let's build high-speed rail view of government. It's much more a defensive view. Let's protect social insurance. Let's ensure there is a meaningful social safety net there, particularly for older people, and one in which healthcare costs are controlled and don't ruin business. But other than that, we want to have an equitable tax burden. The extent to which richer Americans have been able to pay less tax in the last decade and a half has just, gone too far. We're not saying go back to the tax rates of the 1950s and 60s. We're saying go back to the tax rates of the 1990s. 1990s was a successful decade. It was broad-based growth. You have to worry about education. You have to worry about access to education of many people lower on the income scale. That's a huge problem. It is not something that's been tackled mostly at the federal level in the past, and I doubt that the federal government will be able to take it on effectively in the future. It's something for communities, for state and local level government, and for communities to share across with each other in a much more spontaneous, decentralized manner. But ultimately, lack of education for lower income people is going to be a huge impediment to economic growth and reasonable sharing of the benefits in that growth.
I absolutely agree. I'm also very concerned that the latest study, in fact, I was going to report on it today, but I will tomorrow, shows that 56% of all college graduates today who are graduating today with a baccalaureate degree will not have a job. And those who are able in the next 24 months to get a job, it'll be as a bartender, underemployed to their qualifications and their needs, and not going to help them at all. Even lawyers who are now on food stamps out of law school because, and this was a case down in Austin, where two different law students are on food stamps and they can't find work and they can't pay back their debt. And so we not only are going to have a problem with people getting educations that they need, but those who have quality educations and have worked hard are not just walking out, as we all did when we graduated from college, to find a good job or even have multiple jobs to select from that met our needs. So I think that we had better look very carefully at the real environment which we're in, and I think we make a great mistake not sitting down and talking with small business people in every community in America and ask them, how long you been here? What do you do? How many times do you think the dollar that comes to your hand and you spend or comes to someone else circulates in this economy? What could help you hire some more employees or expand your business? We're doing nothing for them. All of our energy is put in two opposite directions, and I believe that we could do a lot better in the way of gainful employment and stabilizing some of the economies before they become just ghettos, and we're getting more and more suburban ghettos, not just urban ghettos, and rust belts, if we looked at the rest of America and not just Washington, Wall Street, New York, and Los Angeles. Your thoughts, please.
No, I think that's an admirable economic philosophy, Gary. I think you should take that to every politician you meet. I do find sometimes the small business community a little too captured and captivated by big business. And specifically, I worry about the Chamber of Commerce that claims to represent very broad cross-section of American business, but all too often speaks up just on behalf of what the big banks need. And I think with regard to banking, we really need to look at breaking up our largest banks, reducing the risk they pose to the economy, encouraging those smaller pieces to go back and get re-engaged with communities. We used to be good at community banking in this country, and we've lost that substantially because the consolidation that occurred involved, in part, ignoring grassroots customers. It's not a well-functioning financial system that we have. The banks are out of touch. The banks are very dangerous. They do not have enough equity. They do not have enough shareholder capital to buffer them against losses. And the people in charge of policy have become too captured by the large-scale corporate thinking that led us directly to the crisis of 2008.
As a small business person myself, I have to think about the families of the people, their future. I have to consider everything in that mix of ideas. And I'm wondering what would happen if a new generation of corporatists came to power who didn't look about just this quarter's profit, this year's, bottom line, and cutting jobs, cutting wages, cutting benefits, trampling unions, so they could make that happen, so they could have that shining moment and get themselves reloaded with options. Instead, look at the long term, where they didn't make making the profit or the benefits to themselves and their shareholders the number one concern, but the long term sustainability of themselves within a larger community that supported that community that historically existed after World War II, where you and I know that if you went to work in one of those companies, there was a high probability you would work there the rest of your working life and could retire and stay in that community, which stayed vital and healthy. That's not a part of the consciousness today in America in many corporations, and I'm concerned about that. Your final thoughts on this, please.
Well, I think, Gary, the world has changed in many ways, and it's hard to go back to what we had after World War II. I think the best we can do is help people prepare themselves for what comes in the American economy and in the global economy. And to that, you need education. And you need a lot of education. You need to keep educating yourselves. From a governmental point of view, I would emphasize we need to be careful. We need to regain that spirit of fiscal responsibility. The Europeans lost it in the past decade or so, and now all Europeans are paying a very high price. We don't have to go there. We can avoid that. We need to talk openly, clearly, honestly with our politicians and say, let's have the conversation. What should we have government do? What does it make sense to do? How do we deliver those services or provide Social Security in an effective and sustainable manner? And then how do we pay for it? You shouldn't get too emotional about it. We shouldn't get too fraught about it. It's a sensible discussion, important discussion to have. We haven't had it in a long time. And once we figure that out, we can also tackle how to pay for it in a reasonable manner. And then we can go back to keeping the economy growing and developing good jobs again.
I certainly appreciate the outstanding work in your book, White House Burning, The Founding Fathers, Our National Debt, and Why It Matters to You, web blog site baselinescenario.com. Thank you very much for being with us today, Professor Simon Johnson.
Always a pleasure.
I'm Gary Knoll. That is Simon, Professor Simon Johnson, Ronald Kurtz Professor of Entrepreneurship at MIT Sloan School of Management, and former Chief Economist for the International Monetary Fund, and giving us insights, and I thought some very pragmatic and practical insights on the arguments. And I believe both of us agree that we need the third-party input. Without a third-party input, all we're left with in education, medicine, healthcare, economics, social programs, is we're left with the official mindset. And unfortunately, more often than not, your most innovative ideas, your most humanistic and caring and nurturing guidance does not come from officialdom. It comes from the person who maintains that fierce sense of autonomy, who has the other idea that no one thought was important. And if you doubt me, go back and look at some of the most important innovations in all fields. We need to insist from this moment forward, whatever is going to affect all of us should have representative thoughts from the other part of our society, those who are excluded, those who are the independent thinking, the progressive thoughts, and not just the official thoughts. We're going to come back in a moment and speak with a gentleman who has a great deal. I introduced him, gave his background at the beginning of the program on our brain about being happy and what can we do to allow us to better understand our emotions and our brain and the science of it out there. One question that I didn't have a chance to ask, or a statement I didn't have to ask with my guest, was all of this, where we're going to put our money, our energy, and time, we never talk about the environment and what is the likely outcome of the environment if we simply neglect it. If we say, well, it's not that bad, whether events are human or not human-made, we neglect the environment at our own peril. The latest study shows, quote, 10,000 simulations show warming range of 1.4 to 3 degrees in the near future. We can't tolerate 3 degrees increase in our temperature without cataclysmic environmental events, including the melting of glaciers, flooding, rising of the ocean levels, and flooding of more than 280 million people living in cities immediately at the ocean level. So many things can go bad. I'd like to see us have a forum to put, much like we did the Manhattan Project or in Europe, the Marshall Plan, put some of the best and brightest minds together on getting ahead of the environmental issues and supporting renewable, real renewable energy, not hydrofracking, not oil, not gas, not certainly not nuclear, but all that's out there that can make a difference. And if we put all of our energy and put people, A, we're putting people to work, B, we're investing in something that will help us sustain our future, and we have to bring those issues to the public attention. And yet, no one talks about 10,000 simulations showing warming. It's going up if we don't do anything, and it depends upon how high it goes. I'm just the bearer of that news. I didn't also mention that Joseph Stiglitz, who won the Nobel Prize and was the foremost economist in the world, said that the war in Iraq and Afghanistan is going to run us between $3 and $5 trillion. That we have no problem paying. Irrespective of your position on the war, it's all waste. But put that money into a single help de-ghettoize America, help provide quality education, help forgive student debt. That we seem not to have any tolerance for and or desire for. I just think we have some really miscued and misplaced priorities in our society. That should be discussed as well. George Carlin had something to say about why we are so interested in war and killing. Back with our guest in a moment, but first let's hear from George.
It's the old American double standard. You know, say one thing, do something different. And, of course, the country is founded on the double standard. That's our history. We were founded on a very basic double standard. This country was founded by slave owners who wanted to be free. Am I right? A group of slave owners who wanted to be free. So they killed a lot of white English people in order to continue owning their black African people so they could wipe out the rest of the red Indian people and move west and steal the rest of the land from the brown Mexican people, giving them a place to take off and drop their nuclear weapons on the yellow Japanese people. You know what the motto? You know what the motto of this country ought to be? You give us a color, we'll wipe it out.
You got it.
So anyway, about 80 years after the Constitution is ratified, 80 years later, the slaves are freed. Not so you'd really notice it, of course. Just sort of on paper. And that was, of course, during the Civil War. Now, there's another phrase I dearly love. That is a true oxymoron if I've ever heard one. Civil War. Do you think any country could really have a civil war?
Say, pardon me. I'm awfully sorry.
Now, of course, the Civil War has been over for about 120 years, but
not so you'd really notice it.
Because we still have these people called Civil War buffs, people who thought it was a really keen war. And they study the battles carefully, and they try to improve on the strategies and the tactics to increase the body count in case we have to go through it again sometime. In fact, some of these people actually get dressed up in uniform once a year and go out and refight these battles. You know what I say? Use live ammunition, would you please? You might just raise the intelligence level of the American gene pool. But what do you expect? Hey, come on, this is a warlike country. We come from that Northern European, basically the Northern European genes, the blue eyes, those blue eyes. Boy, everybody in the world learned real quick, didn't they? When those blue eyes sail out of the North, you better nail everything down, mother. Nail it down, strap it down, or they'll grab it. If they can't take it home, they'll burn it. If they can't burn it, they'll f*** it. That's what happened to us. And it's a warlike country. Come on. I mean, forget foreign policy. Even the domestic rhetoric is warlike. Everything about our domestic policy invokes the thought of war. We don't like something in this country, we declare war on it. The war on poverty, the war on drugs, the war on crime, the war on AIDS, the war on cancer. We got the only national anthem that mentions f***ing rockets and bombs in the thing. You know what I mean?
Back in a moment with my guest. Please stay with us. With us, everyone, I'm Gary Knoll. And for those of you who do not have computers or who are out and driving and maybe out of the range, like truck drivers of a radio station, can hear the terrestrial station signal, good news. We have a phone number for you that you can call and hear this program anywhere in North America and Canada. Call 832-280-0066, 832-280-0066. My guest, who I mentioned and gave his biography earlier in the program, Professor Richard Davidson. He is the William James and Vilas Research Professor of Psychology and Psychiatry and holds the directorships of the Weissman Laboratory for Brain Imaging and Behavior and the Laboratory for Effective Neuroscience and the Center for Investigating Healthy Minds at the University of Wisconsin, where he's been teaching since 1984. He's regarded as a leading pioneer in the new discipline of brain research known as effective neuroscience, recipient of many awards, and author of important works including with co-author Sharon Begley, of The Emotional Life of Your Brain, how its unique patterns affect the way you think, feel, and live, and how you can change them. Nice to have you with us today, Professor Davidson.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
I feel we first need to introduce the listeners to a new discipline in brain science known as affective neuroscience that you helped pioneer. In the past, brain research has been very determinist and reductionist, especially as it is perceived in clinical psychiatry. That is the older paradigm, which still persists. And I would like for you to take us to the new paradigm to understand all of this. The two hemispheres are understood as being almost separate countries. Emotions have their own territory and reason has its own. However, your research has debunked the view and takes almost a more systems theory view that it is far more complicated than that, and there are lines of sharing between different parts of the brain occurring when we are introduced to different stimuli and situations that solicit emotion and rational response. So first, please share with us what effective neuroscience is, and then how we need to revise our earlier beliefs about the brain and its functions.
Sure. Well, affective neuroscience is the study of the neural underpinnings of emotion and emotional processes. There was a time when I began my career in the mid-1970s when the study of emotion was relegated to the basement of psychology and psychiatry, and the neuroscientific research that existed, the little that did exist, was almost exclusively conducted in rodents and focused on more primitive mechanisms that were associated with basic drives like hunger and things of that sort, and really did not focus at all on the cortex, which is the more recent evolutionarily more recent part of our brain, and particularly the prefrontal cortex, which is the part, the real estate that sits behind the forehead, which is the most recent evolutionary addition to our brains, and for many years was thought to play a key role, and it is still thought to play a key role in man's highest cognitive functions or thinking functions. Yet our work, beginning early on, suggested that the prefrontal cortex was also involved in emotion, and it was involved in emotion because the prefrontal cortex is critically implicated in the regulation of emotion, in the sustaining, the modulation, the anticipation of emotion, and our work was really one of the first to point out that this area of the brain, which scientists previously regarded as exclusively in the realm of rational thought, played a very important role in emotion as well. And so the distinction between thought and feeling, which is very basic in Western philosophy, is really not a distinction that is honored by the brain. Virtually every brain region which participates in emotion also participates in certain aspects of cognitive function and vice versa. The notion that there are these segregated territories in the brain concerned with each is simply a myth that is really crumbling in the face of modern research.
I appreciate that. Thank you for that overview. You're also a pioneer in providing scientific proof that we can change our brains. We can intentionally shift the circuitry to more positively confront various adverse situations. And this has led to what we now realize is that the brain is neuroplastic. It is mutable and not fixed and static. Could you go into more depth and provide some examples from your research on how this is done?
Sure. So this is a theme which is described in detail in my new book with Sharon Begley. And the idea that there are circuits in the brain that subserve or underpin different emotional styles. These are different dimensions of emotional responding. And given that we know the brain exhibits this quality of neuroplasticity, as you've mentioned, invites the possibility that we can actually change these circuits and alter our emotional styles in ways that may be more positive. So this has led to our view that certain qualities that we think of as emotional qualities that we often assume are relatively fixed, like our well-being or happiness, are actually best regarded as skills. We don't ordinarily think of happiness as a skill or well-being as a skill, but it really is fundamentally no different than learning to play a musical instrument or learning a complex athletic skill. If we practice, we will actually get better, and the practice induces changes in these brain circuits, which can be measured using modern tools of neuroscience, and those changes in the brain actually are associated with changes in our experience and behavior that are associated with this kind of alteration. So we can literally change our brains by transforming our minds. And some of the examples that I describe in the book are based upon both ancient contemplative traditions, like meditation, as well as more modern strategies that come from Western science. I have personally been very interested in meditation, and as I recount in the book, I first met the Dalai Lama in 1992, and he was someone who really inspired and encouraged me to pursue research along these lines, and he was very interested in catalyzing serious neuroscientific research on the minds and brains of practitioners who have been practicing meditation for many, many years. He also challenged me and said that, look, we've used the tools of modern neuroscience to study qualities like fear and anxiety and depression. Why can't we use those same tools to study kindness and compassion? And that was a very pivotal moment for me and marked the transition in my career toward a more explicit commitment to address these positive qualities. And I made a commitment to the Dalai Lama on that day in 1992 that I was going to do everything I could to put qualities like compassion on the scientific map. And so we have found, for example, that simple practices that come from meditative traditions that are designed to strengthen compassion can change the brain in as little as 2 weeks of training, and those changes induce specific alterations in circuits in the brain that we know are important for well-being and positive emotion and empathy. And those changes in the brain are also associated with behavioral changes that can be rigorously measured in the laboratory. And so you can actually alter your emotional style through this kind of simple training, which produces reliable systematic changes in the brain.
I'd like to have you discuss your studies with the Venerable Madhu Ricard, a French Tibetan Buddhist monk with a doctor from the Institute of Pasteur in molecular biology and genetics. I ask you because My executive producer, Richard Gelb, is an old friend of Matu, having worked with him in Nepal back in the 1980s.
Uh-huh.
And following your MRI studies on Matu, he was being touted in the media for a while as the happiest man on earth. And during your research, you had Matu enter into four different meditative states in the MRI tube. Share with us what you discovered about positive emotions during that research.
Certainly. Well, Matu is a very unusual person. As you say, he's French by nationality, but he has been a Tibetan Buddhist monk since 1967, as well as holding a PhD in molecular biology. So he comes with remarkable credentials and with a uncanny ability to bridge these two cultures. And Matu has been instrumental in our research and actually co-authored the very first paper that we published on brain changes in these long-term practitioners. And the scientific paper was at least in part about Matu's own brain. And so it's really kind of a remarkable way to do research. Combining the inner and outer exploration, if you will. One of the types of meditation practices that we asked Matu and other practitioners who have had similar training is to enter into a state of compassion meditation where the practitioner is able to generate a state in which love and compassion permeate the whole mind with no other consideration, reasoning, or discursive thoughts. That's actually a quote from Matu describing what it is that he and the other practitioners are doing. And when they enter into that meditation state, there are a number of dramatic changes that we measure in the brain. There are changes in the ongoing electrical oscillations that we can record from the scalp surface. These are measures that are obtained with brain electrical recordings, and what we see is the expression of very fast frequency activity in the gamma range. That's around 40 cycles per second, and we see it extended over time and highly synchronized across different brain regions. Now, what does all that mean to a layperson? Well, these rhythms are typically seen in a normal person who has not practiced meditation for very, very short bursts, typically less than 1 second. And they are observed during states of focused attention and also when perceptual integration or perceptual binding is occurring. And what this means is when different elements of a percept come together. So if you imagine visualizing a red apple, the color, the shape, the texture of the apple as you bite into it, the gustatory memories all come together in a unified, organized percept, but the binding of all those elements together is something that is very transient. And when we experience that, there's a transient burst of synchronized gamma that is observed in the normal human brain, but it doesn't last for very long. And what's unusual about this compassion state is the display of this gamma rhythm in a synchronized way for long periods of time. And it seems to correspond to what the meditator describes in phenomenological terms as a quality of a vast panoramic awareness that is the background for this meditation. That seems to be reflected in this synchronized gamma. We also see when we probe this meditation practice with functional MRI that some of the specific brain circuits that have been implicated in compassion come online and are activated quite dramatically.
I'm going to ask you just to hold your thoughts, because some of our stations around the United States will be saying goodbye, but people can continue to listen to our discussion, and I'm going to go into the whole aspect of disease fighting in your mind in a moment with my guest, Dr. Richard Davidson. His book is The Emotional Life of Your Brain. And you can continue listening over the telephone if you don't have a computer at 832-280-0066, 832-280-0066, or progressiveradionetwork.com. Please continue.
Great. So thank you. And so just very briefly, what we see with functional MRI is that there are areas in the brain that are important in feeling another person's emotions and in taking the perspective of others that become activated during this compassion practice. And we can track this with functional MRI. And the way we probe the brain with functional MRI during this compassion meditation practice is by presenting emotional sounds to the practitioner, sounds that reflect human suffering, like the sound of a baby crying unconsolably, the sound of a woman screaming. We can then probe how the state of compassion transforms the practitioner's response to these emotional sounds. And that's when we see these circuits important for empathy and perspective-taking coming online and becoming very activated during this compassion practice. So all this work suggests that through the intentional cultivation of certain mental states, we can literally change the function and structure of the brain and promote more positive qualities of mind, more positive habits of mind, if you will, through these kinds of exercises.
Great. I have one additional question, and it'll give you adequate time to complete it. Your findings after studying the brain functions of many advanced meditation experts in Nepal and India and Bhutan who came to your lab at the university, all people have clocked more than 10,000 hours of meditation each and have conducted a minimum of 3-year retreats during a single period, can give people the impression that in order to change their brains, they would need to engage in large amounts of practice of meditation before discovering any real results. However, I don't believe that is the case, so I'm going to ask you to address that and then add into this. A lot of people listening right now are deeply involved in health and spiritual issues and alternative medical modalities. Many are right now dealing either directly or with their friends, family, with mild to life-threatening illnesses. So for their benefit, would you speculate, based on your neuroimaging research into the brain's neuroplasticity, how we can better confront disease and how we can change our brains in a more positive manner to deal with this?
Yeah, well, thank you so much for asking both of those important questions. With regard to the first question, while it's true that the long-term practitioners we've studied have had quite a lot of experience, we've done quite a bit of research on novice practitioners who are just learning to practice for the first time. And we can now say unequivocally that among individuals who've never practiced meditation before, it really doesn't take a lot to show positive, systematic, and robust changes that we can measure in the brain and behavior and in the body after just a few weeks to a few months of practice, just 30 to 45 minutes a day. We have found, for example, in another study that 8 weeks of meditation practice, where practitioners were going to one weekly class that met for about 2.5 hours of class, and then they were asked to do daily practice as well, that in just 8 weeks of practice, not only did we see a change in the brain, but with regard to your second question, one of the things that we did in this study is we gave everyone, those who were in the group learning meditation as well as in a group that was a control group, we gave them a flu vaccine at the end of the study, and we measured the antibody response to the vaccine. And what we found is that the individuals who went through 8 weeks of training, and this was in mindfulness meditation, actually showed a significantly more enhanced response to the flu vaccine. They showed greater antibody titers mounted in response to the vaccine, which means the vaccine was working better after just 8 weeks of meditation in otherwise completely novice practitioners. And so this indicates that there was, we also saw a change in the brain, and it indicates that after just this limited amount of practice, there were robust changes that we think are clinically significant. And so with regard to more about the second question, we know that the circuits that are affected by these practices in the brain are intimately connected to systems in the body that are important for health and illness. These are the immune system, the endocrine system, the autonomic nervous system. There are pathways that go from these brain circuits to all of the different organ systems in our body. And this is a way that the mind can actually influence the body. And we also know that the communication is bidirectional. Signals from the body are transmitted to the brain and modulate and influence the functioning of the brain. And so through these pathways, by taking more responsibility for cultivating positive qualities of mind, we can actually make a difference in our bodies. There is now incontrovertible evidence that happier people are healthier. What we don't yet know is what the mechanisms for it might be, but the work that I'm describing is providing some important clues about what those mechanisms may be.
Well, keep up your outstanding work, Dr. Richard Davidson. We appreciate your being on today. Dr. Davidson's book is The Emotional Life of Your Brain, How Its Unique Patterns Affect the Way We Think, Feel, and Live, and How You Can Change Them. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
I'm Gary Nall. This has been a continuation of our series, Conversations with Remarkable Minds. Have a nice day, everyone.